Judges 12. And the men of Ephraim were called together and went northward and said to Yiftach, "Why have you passed over to fight against the sons of Ammon? You have not called us to go with you. We will burn your house over you with fire." And Yiftach said to them, "I have been a man of war, my people and I, having great strife with the sons of Ammon. And I have called you, and you did not save me out of their hands. And seeing that you did not save us, I put my life in my hand and passed over against the Ammonites. And the Lord delivered them into my hand. And why have you come up to me to fight with me?" And Yiftach gathered all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, "You Gileads are fugitives with Ephraim in the midst of Ephraim and in the midst of Manasseh." And Gilead captured the fords of Yarden before Ephraim. And it happened when the fugitives from Ephraim said, "Let me pass over." And then the men of Gilead said to him, "You are an Ephraimite." And he said, "No." And they said to him, "Please say Shibboleth." And he said, "Sibboleth." And not could frame to speak so. And they would seize him and kill him at the ford of the Yarden. And at that time, 42,000 of Ephraim fell. And Yiftach judged Israel 6 years, and Yiftach the Gileadite died and was buried in the cities of Gilead. And after him, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel, and he had 30 sons. And he sent 30 daughters abroad, and he brought 30 daughters from abroad for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years. And Ibzan died and was buried at Bethlehem. And after him, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel, and he judged Israel 10 years. And Elon the Zebulite died, and he was buried in Ayalon in the land of Zebulun. And after Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite judged Israel, and he had 40 sons and 30 grandsons and rode on 70 colts. And he judged Israel 8 years. And Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, died and was buried at Pirathon and the land of Ephraim in the hills of the Amalekites. Judges 13. And the sons of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, and his name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had not born. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold now, you are barren and have not born, but you shall conceive and bear a son. And now take heed, and please do not drink wine or fermented drink, and do not eat any unclean thing. For behold, you are pregnant and bearing a son, and a razor shall not go on his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to save Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." And the woman came and spoke to her husband, saying, "A man of God has come to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God, very terrifying. And I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. And he said to me, 'Behold, you are pregnant and will bear a son. And now do not drink wine or fermented drink, and do not eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb until the day of his death.' Then Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, 'O my Lord, the man of God whom you sent, please let him come again to us and direct us what we shall do with the boy being born.' And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman, and she was sitting in a field. And her husband Manoah was not with her. And the woman hurried and ran and told her husband. And he said to him, "Behold, he has appeared to me, the man who came to me that day." And Manoah rose up and went after his wife and came to the man. And he said to him, "Are you the man who spoke to the woman?" And he said, "I am." And Manoah said, "Then let your words come about. What shall be the way of the youth and his undertaking?" And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Let her take heed of all that I said to the woman. She shall not eat of anything that comes from the grapevine. She shall not drink wine or fermented drink. And she shall not eat any unclean thing. She shall be careful of all that I commanded her." And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "Please let us keep you and prepare before you a kid of the goats." And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "If you keep me, I will not eat of your bread. And if you prepare a burnt offering, you shall offer it to the Lord." For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "What is your name? When your words come about, then we shall honor you." And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask this about my name? Yea, it is wonderful." And Manoah took the kid of the goats and the food offering and offered on the rock to the Lord. And he did wonderfully. And Manoah and his wife were looking on. And it happened as the flame from off the altar was going up to the heavens, that the angel of the Lord went up in the flame of the altar. And Manoah and his wife were watching. And they fell on their faces to the ground. And the angel of the Lord did not appear any more to Manoah or to his wife. Then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." And his wife said to him, "If the Lord desired to put us to death, he would not have received a burnt offering and a food offering from our hands, nor declared to us all these things, nor would he at this time have caused us to hear such things as these." The woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the youth grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him in the camp of Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol.
Are there any questions or comments of what you just heard? Any things that caught your eye or things you're not quite sure about? It's open for discussion.
I think it's interesting how Samson was... He didn't take a Nazarite vow. He was given one.
He was given one, correct. So was Samuel, years later. Similar vow, in that you were dedicated for Hannah to temple service. Same scenario. Now, granted that Samuel happened to have also been Levite, so it was kind of a, you know, catch-22 combo, but still, he was a Nazarite as well. Nazarite vows is a way in which a non-Levitical person can be of service to God. I mean, if you weren't part of the priesthood, if you wish to work in the temple, there's only one way you're allowed to do it. Nazarite vow. And it lasts for a period of time. You can have a vow for 6 months. You can have a vow for a couple of years. I was discussing the Torah as far as its rules. No wine. No vinegar. Basically, no alcoholic drink at all, technically. No wine or vinegar. No cutting of your hair during the vow period. Or during the vow time cycle. So what they would do, a normal person, if like an adult came and said, "Hey, I want to take a Nazarite vow." The priest said, "That's fine. Let's cut your hair now." They cut it all off. Debatable whether they shaved his head or not. It's called shaved, but we think of shaved like there's no, it's just pure skin. Well, that isn't necessarily true. Shaved just means cut very short. You can still have some hair there. That wasn't the matter. But you weren't allowed to cut it then. Not until your vow was over. When vow was over, of course, there's sacrifices involved in this as well. The priest, the high priest, would cut your hair, the balance of it, and they would burn what you vowed or burn that hair. you can last for, like I said, a year, a couple years, and in some cases, Samson's is one of them, so is Samuel's, a lifetime. Vow didn't end for those two, but that was rare. That's why they recorded. Hey, look, it's so rare, they wrote it down. So yeah, he did not have a choice in the matter, it just was given to him. We'll discuss why and what God was thinking probably the next few weeks as we discuss this subject matter. Because a lot of stories, Samson's story is quite unique amongst most of the judges, in that all of the judges, God selected someone. Samson, he created someone. There is a difference there. Samuel is also, God created a judge out of Samuel by birth. He created one from beginning all the way to the end. Well, Samson's the same way. The other judges, they were already alive. They had lives. They had families. They knew who they were when God selected them. So he's actually a unique character. We'll discuss that as we go through some of the stories and some of the events that happen in his life, because God's handiwork pops his way up quite a few times in telling a story as to why he had to create a Samson and the message he was trying to get across versus some of the others who he was able to select. Any other questions or comments? Yes,
I think it was any fruit of the vine, and they couldn't eat the grape, even eat the fresh grapes or raisins.
Yes, and the reason is, if you go to a vine, you pick a grape off, how long do you wait before it turns to alcohol? Well, you have about 30 seconds to a minute. Alcohol starts forming because yeast is on the outside of the grape. Once you pluck it, it's now touching the sugar. Bam, fermentation starts. And there is no, you don't have like, granted they discussed, some people have narrowed it down to a 20 to 30 seconds time period from it being plucked versus actual alcohol being produced, but that's so short, most people pick grapes, they don't think about, oh, quick, eat them now. So they just ban all grape products. That's true. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, I was just saying, the grape growers say that grapes can pick up a 0.5% of alcohol between the time that it's picked from the vine and when they can get it into the truck, which is about 5 minutes.
Yeah, pretty fast. it starts fermenting very quickly. God built it that way, and not just grapes. A lot of fruit is that way. Plums will do that. There are actually a few other fruits. Citrus doesn't do it, but there are a few of the fruits that have yeast on the outside of the skin. Primarily plums and grapes are two that come to mind on the top of my head. But raspberries, and so do blackberries. Same thing. Yeast on the outside, once you pluck it, fermenting starts. It doesn't waste any time. So yeah, all grapes were technically banned. New, old wine is what's referred to here, which includes vinegar, but all grapes were usually banned in a normal Nazarite vow. Any other comments that I can answer for you, or questions you had about what we read?
This was about not only forced on Samson, but it was forced on his mother.
Yes. Yes, it was forced on her. Now, we don't know how long. It's presumed she was forced upon it until he was weaned.
Right.
It's presumed that that's the time that a minimum took place. She may have done it her whole life. We don't know. The story kind of ends with that as far as what goes on with her. Yes, Susan.
I just thought it was interesting that considering that the angel's name, supposedly the angel's name, was wonderful, that there was two comings of the angel.
Yes.
Right. So it's like a little picture.
Yes, it was. Hopefully we'll get a chance to discuss that today. But we'll get there. Yes, Anne.
The other thing is that, what is his wife's name? She said, could you wait a minute? I'm going to go get my husband. It's like the angel, God waits on us.
Wait for a period of time. It's actually interesting you asked, what was her name? Actually, it's not listed.
Ah, there it is.
We have no idea what her name is.
I don't know what her name is.
Just the woman. Yeah. Manoah's wife. Manoah. That's all we know. We don't have an actual name for her. Yes.
What's the Shibboleth name?
Shibboleth, I do not know. I have looked it up, and I have not found a definitive definition of it. I think it's actually a made-up word. What was that? Not in that spelling, it doesn't. In different spelling, yeah, it's a body of water, but the spelling that was used, at least what I've got recorded down, is not a normal spelling for that word. So I don't know what was going on. I think it was the purpose was that Ephraimites, their dialect did not support the sound shh, the SH sound. Their dialect of Hebrew supported the S sound. That's one of the reasons why in Hebrew you don't have an SH. It doesn't exist in Hebrew language. You have the shin, which is an SH or an S, depending on whether they have a dot on one side for versus the other side. Why? Because if I was Ephraimite, would I pronounce Shalom? No, it would be Salom. So don't put a sh sound in there, or some other, the sh sound will be gone. Yes.
That difference in the S and SH sound still prevails in that area. There's a site of Tel Heshbon in Jordan, and the Israelites call it Heshbon.
Heshbon, yes. Yes, it's still, that is true. I've seen both spellings. I didn't think about that, but thank you for that connection.
Yeah, well,
that is true. They do still have that issue. Yes.
You think of like Arabic and Hebrew, Shalom.
Yeah, exactly. The SH sound is gone, or is missing in one versus the other language. Which is quite interesting, actually. See, I don't have a definition for the spelling that was given here. You're probably right. I mean, some probably a dialect or version of the body of water, but I can't swear to it. I don't know for sure. Okay. But before we go there, let's go back to chapter, well, Samson, that is. Let's go back to chapter 12 and finish off Jephthah. All right. Jephthah, as we we're leaving him technically. We kind of left him sort of as we moved on 13, but first of all, what do you guys remember about Jephthah? The previous chapter 11, and obviously part of chapter 10, we discussed quite a detail about his character, his lifestyle, what he did, what his technique was. He was Torah observant and a reader. He knew all the history of the Israelite people, though he was an outcast. Actually, we're going to play it. We're going to focus on this whole outcast thing, because it's layered upon layered upon layered of outcasts that are going through his particular line. And we discussed, let's see, what else did we discuss regarding him? Oh, his daughter, of course. My personal belief, given the evidence in the Bible, it pointed out that she grieved her virginity, not her life. Thus, she probably was not actually killed. She most likely just dedicated to temple service, as a female would normally be done. You cannot benefit anyone. You cannot marry in that format. We have other examples in the Bible of people in that scenario. We have, I think her name was Anna, the book of Luke. She was a widow, hadn't been seen with a man for, how many decades?
Yeah, she was only married
7 years. And she's like 40-some-odd years being there at the temple service, never left day or night. She was one of those examples. She did not benefit anyone, meaning she did not marry anybody. She was not allowed to serve anyone. She just served God. That was her life, what she did with her life. Yes, those daughters, probably the exact same way. Not uncommon. It did happen. We think of Nazirite vows as being male. Well, that's not what the Bible says. Male or female, you can make either vow. Either gender can make the vow. It makes no difference. It's a lifetime service or a period of time service. Okay, so that's what we know about Jephthah. We know he was a Gileadite. Gilead. He was the son of Gilead's concubine. All right? No one liked him. He was outcast amongst his brothers, the other Gilead descendants. All right? We recalled correctly a little bit about his history. He lived in the land of Tov, which is roughly there. It's a little bit southeast of Sea of Galilee or Lake Kinneret, however you wish to call it. That was his area. He was outcast too. Technically, he was lived a couple miles south of there, which is where his family was, where his daughter and wife lived. That's where I can't remember the name of the town off the top of my head. So he was outcast up north by other Gileadites. Why? What did they say? They wanted his property. They didn't believe he was legitimate descendant of their father because he came from a different mother. Thus, everything he owned, they wanted. So they cast him out, but kept all of his land, kept all of his property, right where they belonged. So he had to leave. Comes back, saves Gilead. Years go by from Ammon. Ephraim. I don't know if you remember or not, but a few months ago we had discussed about the difference between the book of Judges and the book of Joshua. All right? There's a perspective going on here. Book of Joshua was written by, we don't know for sure, most likely Joshua. But we don't know. We don't know who actually wrote it. But it looked very favorably upon the descendants of Ephraim, as well as, for the most part, the descendants of Judah. Well, the book of Judges doesn't look favorably upon Ephraim at all. Favorable, thank you, that's the right word. Does not look positive upon them. that's the word too many times. Ephraim is actually kind of a pathetic northern tribe. What does that give us? Most likely, it wasn't written, Book of Judges, was not compiled by someone from Ephraim, if it looks unfavorably toward Ephraim. Makes logical sense, right? That's why Samuel was given Ephraim's or the credit for writing Book of Judges, because he's from Benjamin, or that area, I should say. Okay, what did Ephraim do? We just read this. What did they do? They got all the guys together, right? Mustered up, they crossed to the north, which, by the way, there are three primary crossings of the Jordan at this time. There's obviously a whole lot more now, but back then there wasn't so many because they didn't have that many bridges. He had to guard so many of them. They did not cross down south. They crossed, as it points out, up north, which means the upper, near the Sea of Galilee, in that area. They crossed up north. Say to Jephthah, why did you cross over and make war against the children of Ammon and did not call on us to go with you? We shall burn your house in fire upon you. It is pretty dumb. It is fairly foolish of them to do so. Does this sound familiar to anybody?
Thunder.
Son of thunder?
In the New Testament, where they asked Messiah if they should call down fire.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's true. That could be. I want to focus on a different subject matter. Anybody remember Gideon?
Yes.
Remember vaguely about him? Do you recall which tribe he was from?
Manasseh,
the other half of Manasseh. So Gideon was from over here. And Jephthah is from up here. Well, this general area. Both descendants of Manasseh. What did Ephraim do to Gideon when he went to war?
He sat it out until the last possible minute.
And then they came into battle at the last minute. And then what did they do? They went up to Gideon and said, how dare you not call upon us to come save you? To not fight upon these horrible, I think they were the Midianites at the time. How dare you not call upon us? This is disgraceful. How were we not good enough for you? And he said, no, wait a minute. I had 300 men, this is Gideon speaking, way up here in the valley of the Megiddo area. We chased down south, and you took out two generals by yourself. So Gideon appeased them. Said, hey, wait a minute, you guys did a wonderful job in your battle. You did something that we couldn't do. You took out two generals that were running south in the sea, so praise yourself. And Ephraim was like, well, okay, that's true. We did it better than you guys did. And so they went home. Come Jephthah, also from Manasseh. What does Ephraim do? He gathers the men together. Why didn't you come to invite us to this battle? In this case, he's going to burn their house. Now, Jephthah is not a diplomat, or is not somebody who...
careful with his words.
Yeah, he's not careful with his words. That's a good way of wording it. He's not a good politician. Unlike Gideon, who appeased Ephraim... And note, I mentioned earlier, not today, but when we first started Book of Judges discusses Ephraim's ability to try to expand. If you recall correctly, the time the kings showed up, Israel pretty much broke into two halves. All right, there was the southern tribes and the northern tribes. Southern tribe was dominated by Judah, and Ephraim dominated the northern tribes. All right, they were the predominant tribe in this whole region. They were bigger, they were stronger. We discussed... A lot of it has to do with where they were located. Their little tribe territory was in the most fertile area and well-protected, insulated, because they had tribes on all sides of them. So if the enemy comes, are they the first one to get hit? No. They get to build up, build their forces, muster themselves together, and then go to battle, unlike the other tribes, which in the outskirts, they're hit all the time. So Ephraim's exerting its force over the next 300, or these past 200 years in the Book of Judges. So we're going about another 100 years or so before they actually, 150, before they actually take over most of the northern tribes. So Ephraim's trying to, his growing pains. They want to exert force upon their brothers. And Manasseh, being their older brother, is the easiest one to pick on. Why is that? Why would Ephraim have issues with Manasseh? Ephraim has had judges, and they had some good judges and some okay judges. Manasseh has had at least this is their second judge.
Well, Ephraim shares a border with Manasseh.
That's true. They do share a border with it. Well, something about Ephraim. Look back. Back in the blessings. Recall the blessings from Israel. Jacob. Jacob upon Joseph's son, Ephraim and Manasseh. He crossed his hands over.
Yeah.
One's older, Manasseh. One's bigger, yes, Manasseh is. But the younger one will dominate the older one. Not at that moment, obviously. It wasn't during Jacob's lifetime. But it's happening now. Is that they're beginning to pick on their older brother. It's just, that's the way God commanded it to happen. He allowed the blessing to occur from Jacob, and he fulfilled it. He fulfilled most of the blessings that Jacob spoke. One that's quite debatable whether he's fulfilled it yet or not, but we don't discuss that today. So Ephraim's getting a little bit of bullying going on. They're practicing their bullying skills. They get smacked pretty hard from Jephthah, but that's their own mistake. What was Jephthah's response? He gives them three reasons why they should not burn his house down. First one, man of great strife was I and my people against the children of Ammon. I summoned you, but you do not save me from their hand. We'll stop there for a second. Jephthah actually didn't summon Ephraim. Gilead summoned Ephraim. I mean, the Gilead, the region, the governors, the territory asked for help. And when Ephraim didn't show up, they said, okay, now we're on our own. Then they found Jephthah. They went to battle and Jephthah won. So Jephthah didn't actually, but his line did. His family asked and they didn't come and help. Verse 3, I saw that you were not helping, so I placed my life in my hand, and I crossed over the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Now, why have you come up to me this day to make war with me? Points out that he was the one who summoned, or that they summoned them. They didn't come and help. The Ammonites predominantly occupied Gilead. Predominantly occupied Gilead. Means that was the territory. Why? Because that's closest to them. If you recall the story between the king of Ammon and Jephthah, they were saying, hey, I want my territory back. And Jephthah's pointing out, this never was your territory. You lost it 300 years ago. And not even to us. You lost to somebody else. And then we took it from them. So there was a big fight going back. But it was predominantly this area of Gilead, which is consists of half a tribe of Manasseh's territory, virtually all of Gad's territory, and a very small, well, technically nothing of Reuben. That was more of Moab's issue. So that was the second issue. Third one, Jephthah risked his family and his family's life. Ephraim didn't. They come up after the scene and say, okay, now it's your fault that we didn't go to war, so we're going to go ahead and destroy you. It's a screwy way of thinking. But it gives a little bit more insight as to the character and why God selected Jephthah for this service. We're going to discuss this actually probably at least for the next couple of minutes or not. Well, 3 minutes. Verse 4. Jephthah assembled all the men of Gilead, warred against Ephraim, and the men of Gilead struck Ephraim for even my book says refuse, but that's for a reason. We'll talk about it for a minute. The refuse of Ephraim said, of what worth are you, Gilead, you who dwell in the midst of Ephraim, in the midst of Manasseh? Okay. We have a couple of layers of outcasts going on here. Do you recall, I mentioned earlier today, that Gilead, his brothers, cast Jephthah away. They drove him out to take his property. So Jephthah starts out his interaction with God as an outcast, an undesirable person. All right, which is somewhat ironic, because Gilead is actually an outcast amongst Manasseh. They were warriors. They were killers. They conquered, they destroyed, they took. That was their profession. They were quite talented at it. But they're actually an outcast. That's why they have their own region of Gilead amongst the region of known of Manasseh and Gad. They have their own little territory, which they were all confined to. this family. So amongst the half of Manasseh, which were all warriors, Gilead was an outcast amongst them. And Yephthah, of course, was an outcast of Gilead. Well, this half of Manasseh happens to also be an outcast amongst this half of Manasseh. Because they're on the other side of the river. They didn't want to come in. They didn't want to, quote, fight, as what it was believed. Which, of course, they did come and fight. They're the most talented warriors they had. And they're quite good at what they did. They did come and fight, but they were considered an outcast because they were on the other side of the river. And this is where it gets interesting. Ephraim considers his brother an outcast because he's the one that God didn't like. God likes me. God's raising me up. Both of which are sons of Joseph, who is an outcast amongst his brothers. You see, layers and layers are building up. God selected a person that was the least likely to be a judge. Yephthah. The outcast which no one liked, no one wanted. And actually, I'm using the word outcast. The proper word is refuse. It's the dung. It's the garbage you want to throw away. That's what's actually referred to, the Hebrew word for it. It's usually translated as rabble, rebels, things that no one likes, but it's actually, it's human waste is what it's referred to. That's what this word actually is used for. Yes, the bowels of human, yes, this happened a couple of months ago. So that's what they are. Now, so Yephthah, of course, sent with all his people, and they actually throw the tables back on Ephraim. They capture this little spot, this little crossing, and all of Ephraim's men are where? On the wrong side. So they actually, Yephthah cut them off. He went to war against them, but he cut them off. They couldn't go back home. They all have to cross the road, cross it at one point or another to get back home, and he knew how to do it. Yephthah wasn't dumb. As mentioned a couple weeks ago, we were discussing him. He was a marauder. That was his profession. He would go out, attack Ammon, take a few of their goods, and come home again. That was the way he paid his bills. He had his men that went with him, did the same thing. That was their profession. That's why they were hired or requested to come and lead all of Gilead and be judge over all of Israel. Because they were good at killing Ammonites. That's what they were good. There's a reason why these guys were called warriors. They're fighters. They're killers. They're trained professional killers. Even when Deborah, when she needed help, who came to assist her? The generals of Manasseh. Well, why are they called generals? Because they're trained killers. That's who they were. So he knew how to take out Ephraim's army. You cut them off from the back, and guess what? They're all stuck. Simple little test. Can you pronounce the SH sound of this word? Mm-hmm. You can't? You're dead. Mm-hmm. Now, we may ask, what about other tribes? What if the person was from Gad and couldn't pronounce the word? Well, no, that wasn't the case, because apparently, I don't know why, this part I have not figured out yet, but most of the cities in Ephraim, if you look at their spelling, they don't have an SH. Most of the cities in all the rest of it, look at their spelling, guess what? SH. there is a little bit. There are a few exceptions, but not very many. There were exceptions prior to Ephraim showing up in their territory. So I'm suspecting they happen to be the only ones who had a hard time pronouncing the SH sound. That's my guess. Great test. He slaughters 42. Mine says thousands, but it also says clans of Ephraimite men. It's a lot of people. Now, we're going to discuss clan versus family today, but that's another thousand today, but that's another issue for another time. So as I finish off Ephraim, real quick here. Yephthah judged Israel for 6 years. Very short period of time. Why is it so short?
He's too busy fighting.
Yeah. You think of who his brothers were. They were all descendants of Gilead. All right? Now, I don't know if you all remember this, but the judges that were judges just before Yephthah were also sons of Gilead. And they just for 20 years, another 20 years. Yephthah's actually very old when he became judge. That's why he was so distraught when his daughter cannot produce children because his family line dies. Now, we always think, oh, well, he can have more children. Not at that age, he and his wife can't. That's it. That's why he grieved so much. He grieved for his family line, that he would not have children. He's an old man. He died 6 years, short period of time. And also, it's a stressful job. Don't get me wrong. It's not easy being a judge of Israel. So let's move on. We have Eban of Bethlehem, who is Jewish, down here. He comes and he judges Israel for a few years. I'm not going to discuss all these details, but 30 sons that sent out 30 daughters. Okay, Jewish tradition. Inheritance is passed through males, right? So when you have a son, does your son leave you? No. Your son stays around so that when you die, they get your property. That's how families worked back then. Today, it's the other way around. The daughters usually stick around home and the sons go off and go make their own way in life. Well, back then, that wasn't the case because inheritance had to stay through the family. He had 30 daughters, 30 sons. 30 sons stayed home. 30 daughters went out, meaning they went, found husbands elsewhere. Go marry whoever you wish kind of thing. Which also means he brought 30 females back in for his sons, but we're going to discuss all that detail. Let's see. So that's why it says, he brought 30 daughters for his sons from without. He brought in 30 daughters from his sons. After him, Elon the Zebulun from up here. Zebulun judges. He's actually, I think, the only judge from Zebulun. Which, not saying a whole lot, but Asher never had a judge. Oh well. he is buried, he dies buried, obviously for 10 years. He's judging Israel. Then, of course, you have Abdon, son of Hillel, Pirathon, which is Ephraimite. He judges Israel. Okay, any questions regarding chapter 12 and the end of Jephthah's story before we jump into Samson? Eek, I'm running out of time.
Yeah.
Yes, Tammy.
I almost wonder, like, this judge, this Isbon, yeah, these other judges had probably lots of sons and daughters, too. But I think, I almost wonder if the reason that they emphasize this a little bit is that I wonder if it's because of that, for the most part, you marry within your own tribe.
That is true.
So it makes an emphasis that when he
brought daughters from without,
he allowed them to marry men outside the tribe.
Yep.
And then when he brought in women for his sons, they were also from outside.
Outside the tribe, exactly.
There's an emphasis to this.
That's one of the Jewish commentaries brought the same thing up. That's was why it was recorded. Otherwise, who cares if he has 30 sons, 30 daughters? What's he do? He probably has lots of wives. That's probably why he can do it. Mm-hmm. But what's the matter? Well, it's the reason it's recorded because they'd be the same reason you just did, is that he brought him from other tribes. Brought him in and brought him out. It was a smart way of doing it. I won't say why, because there's a couple of reasons why it's a smart way of doing it. One is the daughter's less likely to go home if they have a long distance to travel. She doesn't like the husband she's stuck with. but it also brings in other, to increases family ties from one tribe to the other. Yeah, exactly. Family ties from one tribe to another tribe, which is an issue that Ephraim and Manasseh need to fix and work on, which they haven't done at this point. And of course, the other one with the 40 sons, 30 grandsons, riding on 70 colts. Why are we discussing that issue? Judge of Israel, when you traveled for court reasons, meaning you traveled from one region to the region, and you had a biblical law issue to discuss, how did you get there? You rode a colt. So, what were his sons and grandsons helping him with?
Judging.
Commonly done. We already discussed this. It happened once before and a few judges prior. His sons did the same thing. They traveled on colts. And their task was to help him judge legal matters throughout all of Israel. One person, can you imagine one judge for the state of California?
No.
That person would never sleep. That would be nonstop work. Okay, so yes, California is significantly larger than Israel, but the traveling might as well be the whole world. It makes no difference. So one person doing everything is quite difficult. Hence, you have lots of people doing various tasks. And having bigger families makes that task a lot easier to work. Gideon did the same thing with his sons before Abimelech killed them all. okay. Let's finish up. Let's go to chapter 13. I got to get through Samson real quick. We won't discuss the moral of chapter 12 yet. That will be done for a later time when I do recap. But chapter 13. Now, hold on, make sure I didn't miss anything on chapter. Okay, I didn't. All right. This is the longest time period some other country occupies parts of Israel. 40 years. Philistines ruled Israel. Now, this is quite unique. I don't know if you recall or not, but I told you when a judge rules for a given period of time, let's say it's 20 years, and it discusses that they got rid of, you know, king of so-and-so, you know, Moab, for example, expelled him, and because Moab occupied Israel for 5 years. I'm just using this as an example. It's not a legitimate one, but just an example. The 20 years allocated to that judge as far as a time cycle includes those 5 years from Moab. So he actually judged Israel independent of Moab for 15 of those years. The first five, Moab was ruler. Samson is the exception, or is one of the exceptions. He judges Israel for, when we get to it, 20 some odd years. Well, the Philistines ruled Israel for 40 years. So how is Samson allocated only 20? Because Samson did not expel the Philistines. Eli, his successor, still works on it and doesn't expel the Philistines. It takes a long time to expel the Philistines. So Samson is just a judge. He does not deliver Israel. Deliver means to free them. He doesn't expel and destroy all Philistines. He just begins the task. Because even David fights the Philistines, and they've been around for a long time. They're still around, actually, all the way through Nebuchadnezzar. Philistines are still hanging around. So they never go away. Okay, certain man of Zoah, named Manoah, from Danite tribe. His little town is Zora, near the border of Dan and actually the tribe border of Dan, Philistia, and Judah. It's right next to the crux of all three areas. It's Eshtol, which is the end of the chapter, is another town. It's literally the half mile away or so at the time, short distance of travel. Again, very close to the border area. Basically, Samson, as we go through his story, he pretty much stays in this little region. From Bethlehem up through, actually, technically, he goes all the way to the coast at one point. That's pretty much where he lives. He doesn't go anywhere outside there. Unlike some of the judges, which they scatter around, do their judge work throughout all of Israel, Samson doesn't do that. Samson's not a legal person. He's not a legal judge, meaning he does not discuss legal matters. It wasn't his task. It wasn't what God brought him up or created him for. Manoah, his father. Now, I note, point out his wife, of course, her name's not mentioned. I mentioned that earlier. A lot of speculation as to why her name's not mentioned, but we'll go through all of them. One is that it just didn't matter, wasn't important at the time, which is what the Jewish people like to say. I won't say they're right or wrong, that's just their position they advocate. The other perspective, which is also a Jewish scholar as well, points out that why, if she wasn't important, did the angel come to her instead of to Manoah? I mean, in Abraham and Sarah, the angel came to Abraham. So why is it that in Manoah and his wife, the angel goes to his wife and talks to her?
It's a type.
Say it again?
It's a type.
It is a type. It is a type. It is a character type with somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know who the type is?
Miriam.
Miriam. Angel goes to her, not her husband. Her husband is secondary. He talks to her. Actually, I don't think he actually talks to her husband. He might talk to her husband. Mary's husband, I don't remember. I remember all these stories. Too many floating through my head at a time. But he does... He does talk to Miriam, though, first. She's the most important. Now, of course, her name's recorded. I'll give her credit for that. But unfortunately, Manoah's wife's not recorded. So we'll discuss a little bit more about Manoah and who he was and why God would come to him a second time as we go through this chapter. His wife is barren. Now, angel actually says his man, technically, of God, appeared to the woman, said to her, "Behold, now you're barren." All right, listen to his words. "You shall conceive, give birth to a son. Do not drink wine or aged wine," wine or vinegar, or technonazorite, no grape product at all. "Do not eat anything contaminated," which means unclean. "For you shall conceive, give birth to a son, a razor shall not come upon his head," he's a Nazarite vow, "for the lad shall be a Nazarite of God from the womb, and he will begin to save Israel from the land of the Philistines." No one has saved Israel from the land of Philistines. No one started to save Israel from the land of Philistines until Samson shows up. Why? Why didn't God want the land saved from the Philistines before Samson shows up? It seems like a reasonable question. Philistines at this point in time have been occupying this territory for almost 300 years.
It's a prophecy.
Yes, it is a prophecy. Do you know what the prophecy is?
It's yet future.
Well, yes. It's a prophecy that Abraham did.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't remember or not, but in the book of Genesis, Abraham struck a deal. Struck a deal with a certain king. And the king happened to rule Gath and Ashkelon and Asherod. I think that's how I pronounce it right. Three cities. That was the king's ruleship, and that territory is in currently the land, at this point in time, the land of Philistines. What was the deal between Abraham and the king? You don't come after me, I don't come after you. My descendants won't come after you, your descendants don't come after my descendants. And we'll be at peace. King said, okay. Now, of course, the king had confronted Abraham with his generals behind him and ready to go to war. I don't think Abraham was interested in a war between this guy, who was probably considerably more wealthy than he was. So he made a deal with that. I believe it was Abraham. It might have been Isaac. I thought it was Abraham.
I think it was Isaac. Maybe. I don't know.
Isaac did it again with a different king. Well, same name. I hate that. They use the same name a lot of times. But it's a different king that Isaac does a similar deal with. But that was with well issues, not a territorial issue. Isaac is also Abimelech something, king of whatever. Isaac runs across him, and so does Abraham run across a different one, his father or grandfather. But we don't know for sure. So they don't get to occupy the territory until God says. And has God said you can occupy the territory? Look at modern-day map. Has God said you can occupy this territory? No, he hasn't. As Susan just pointed out, Gaza Strip. Israel still does not occupy the Gaza Strip. God has not fallen short the deal that Abraham struck. It's a long time. Mm-hmm. Look at it. Almost 4,000 years that God made that promise. And the Gaza Strip still exists today, independent of Israel. Now, granted, yeah, people argue, well, what's independent? Yeah, they pay one another to stay alive. Yeah, but Israel would love to have Gaza Strip disappear. And they have yet to do it. Because God has not allowed it to happen yet. So the promise that Abraham and that king made still holds true. Now, you point out, but these are Philistines now. Back then, it weren't Philistines. It doesn't matter. The territory is the same. The people may have changed, but the territory never changed. Because Abraham's deal was a territorial border that they struck, not a people border. So it hasn't changed today. But begin, Philistines were a strong, powerful people. They were taking over most of Israel at this point in time. They begin to fight back, meaning push them back to their borders. David couldn't stop them. No one could stop them. Even Nebuchadnezzar couldn't stop them. Gaza Strip's still around. So you can't take away the Philistines, but you can push them back to the border they belong to. Why did I focus on that? Because she never mentions that to her husband at all. The angel said, listen to the words carefully, Nazarite from God from whom, and he will begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Listen to what she records to her husband. A man of God came to me, his parents like the parents of an angel of God, very awesome, didn't ask what his name was or where he was from. Behold, you conceive, give birth to your son, and now do not drink wine or aged wine, do not eat anything contaminated, for the lad shall be Nazarite unto God from the womb until his death. Does she mention save Israel, or save from the Philistines? No. Did she leave anything else out? No, she didn't leave anything else out. No, we are. Well, she didn't talk about the razor in the head. Well, she used the word Nazarite. That means no razor shall cut your head. I mean, you don't have to repeat yourself twice. So she didn't mention that, but she made sure she neglected that one statement, which I think is important to why she selected his name as Samson. By the way, she named him. Her husband didn't. Manoah prayed to God. please, may the God come who you sent come back to us, teach us what we should do with the lad. Basically, I want a confirmation. Verify that my wife's not, you know, crazy. We don't have kids yet. Tell me that this is actually going to happen. God listens to him, has compassion upon Manoah, and comes to visit Manoah? No. The angel goes back to the wife. Why? Well, for practical reasons, he wouldn't recognize him. He wouldn't know, he had no clue who he was looking at. She would recognize what the angel looked like. But this affects her more than does him, obviously. She's the one who gave birth. But she's the one who has to name him. And there's a reason she left that information out, the saving Philistines. Because the angel leaves the same information out as well. He doesn't tell Manoah to say they should save the Philistines. The woman hastened, this is verse 10. She ran, told her husband, she said, "Behold, the man of Cain, he's appeared." Manoah goes after him. Continue on down. Let's see. Verse 12, "May your words come true. What should the conduct of the lads and his behavior be? The angel said of Manoah, 'Everything that I spoke to the woman, she should beware. Of any comes from the grapevine, she shall not eat. Wine or aged drink, she shall not drink. Anything contaminated, she shall not eat. Everything I commanded her, she shall observe.'" Did he mention anything about saving Israel or from the Philistines? No, he doesn't. So Manoah doesn't get this information. He doesn't receive it. But it's going to play later on, a couple of chapters from now. He's not supposed to know what's happening. It would defeat God's purpose of creating Samson from scratch. He wants to make sure his father doesn't know his destiny. It would affect what happened, in fact, to what his father would have done as Samson goes for his first wife. See, of course, then it says, "No, please stay, we'll eat." Manoah and his wife think this is a man. Now, why would they think that? Looks like a man. But she said his appearance appeared like an angel of God. Does she know what an angel of God looks like? Not likely. I don't know what an angel of God looks like. As far as I know, it looks like a person. Or maybe, as mentioned earlier today in the Torah study, you can't see a spirit, can you? Of course not. But he had an aura about him, something about him that was giving her the impression he was a very important person. This is Manoah. I like this part. It's one of the things I like about him. They offer it, "If you detain me, or I shall not eat your food, but thus for an elevation offering instead." And Manoah didn't know that he was an angel. He asked him, "What's your name? So that when your word comes about, we may honor you." What does that mean? How do you honor an angel of God?
You don't.
You don't. That's why he didn't give his name.
That's right.
What if this was just a man?
You don't want to honor him either.
Well, you'll probably say your name
and my name. Keep in mind, granted, this has been almost over a year ago, I discussed this issue. What is the definition of a prophet? One who states a position of the future, something that's going to happen, defending and obeying God, but it has to come true. If I go around spouting off garbage that I think is going to happen tomorrow, and it doesn't happen, am I a prophet?
No.
Of course not. Now, what if it all happens? Am I a prophet? Well, maybe, depending on how well I predicted. If I said, like, well, sun's going to rise, well, that doesn't mean a whole lot. But if I say something big is going to happen, and it does that make me a prophet? Assuming it does, I didn't do anything illegal, like immoral. It does. If it comes true, if I predict a future event, then it comes true. That's what the prophets did. That was one of their main occupations, is predicting what's going to happen in the future. You call Jeremiah the prophet, he is the whole yoke. The yoke will not break, but the false one next to him broke his yoke.
A lot of people go to a prophet and find the answer.
Exactly. They find an information. So, if I am an upstart, a young person desiring to be a prophet, and I make a prediction, how is anybody on earth going to know that it came true? Thus, I will become a prophet.
You have to wait and see.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. If I tell you something and you're the only person who knows it, and it comes true for you and you don't tell anybody that I told you anything, will anybody know that I predicted it happening? Of course not. You would. But that's it.
That's how you define a prophet. Manoah's issue is he's saying, hey, tell me your name, tell me where you're from. Thus, when it comes true, I will verify you are in fact a prophet. Thus, everyone will know you were a prophet. Thus, you will be brought into an elevated status amongst Israel. People will come to you and pay you for your service. That's what prophets do. If he was a man, that would be exactly what he would want. Because otherwise, he's got to work, you know, like, you know, hand to the bone kind of thing to make his living. Prophets don't work so hard. They go through other issues that no one wants to do, but they don't have to necessarily do physical labor. There are hazards that go with being prophets. But at this point in time, not so many of them are that bad. That's how you'd honor a prophet. But of course, name is concealed or name is fantastic. However, mine says his name is hidden. Obviously, other translations, incomprehensible, unspeakable, unknowable. Corey takes the kid, meal offering, they burn it. I'm not going to go through the whole story all again because I'm out of time. Prophet disappears, find out, it's an angel, not a prophet. Now, whether or not he thought it was an angel because he disappeared, or whether because he went into the flame and disappeared, I don't really know. It doesn't make much difference. Either way, he's gone. He realizes who he was with. Of course, they give birth. Manoah's concerned by this whole, we saw a God of the angel, God's going to kill us now. His wife consoles him. That's not the case. Think this through. Watch what's going on. You're fine. Granted, I'd be a little petrified too. If I was going through that and I saw this angel, I would be scared to death. I would probably drop down and say, God, please don't kill me now. You know, that kind of thing. It's a human instinct. It happens. It's normal. It's fear.
Well, that's what most of all, we said, fear not when they appear.
It is. Fear not. Don't worry. Don't be petrified. It's okay. Why is this story in here? Why is a story about Manoah and his wife in this section? Why didn't God just say, well, I'm going to select someone and say, okay, Samson, you're now a judge, like he did all the other judges? There's a purpose to this story as why it's here. Yes, Tim.
I think one part of it is that it shows that his wife is smarter than he is.
That is true. That is true. I'll
like
definitely.
Why the angel is smarter than her.
She.
No, I think it depicts women and men very accurately. I mean, the more intuitive of the woman and the more pragmatic behavior of
that's,
the male.
That's true. On a humanistic standpoint, that is absolutely true.
Yeah.
But what does that help with God? How does that assist God's goal?
I think they had a sense of faithfulness.
Okay, now we're getting somewhere. There's actually something unique about Manoah and his wife, and about this particular story. They were very faithful. Manoah's faith was based upon what? According to the story, it appears fear. His faith appears to be based more upon fear than anything else.
I think it was the fact that he's seen the angel. He spoke with
him.
And he's seen him.
He didn't trust his wife initially. Well, didn't was questioning her. But that's a minor point. I actually want to focus on whatever his faith. It doesn't make a difference. Focus on Haggai chapter 2 verse 5. I know it's a long ways away.
Yes.
Instead of like other Bible here, I'm going to throw it up here. Haggai chapter 2 verse 5. Whoever gets there first, will you please read it for me? Because I'm going to take a little while.
As for the promise which I made you when you came out of Egypt, my spirit is abiding in your midst. Do not fear.
Stop. It's actually a unique thing going on here. Because Samson, unlike all of the other judges before him, God's spirit, it doesn't explicitly state that God's spirit is with them. At any moment in time, Moses is an exception. He's not really a judge. He's his own category. Samson, God's spirit, comes and helps him periodically throughout his life. It's actually a change in our storyline, change in our judge patterns. We initially started out with judges that were fantastic men to begin with. God selected them, says, you are fantastic. I'm going to make you greater. You will judge all of Israel. We have Moses. We have Joshua. Then he started to select men who weren't necessarily great, but they were still pretty good. You have Othniel. You have Ehud. You have Deborah. Then you start to see God selecting men that weren't really even that good. They were just okay. You have Gideon. I can't remember the next gen's name off the top of my head. I forgot it. After Gideon, there's another one too. Abimelech, that was it, his son. Not a very good judge, 3 years, doesn't really count, kind of a jerk, but that's okay. So you have people who are actually slowing, or going down and down and down in quality prior to God selecting them. Jephthah being, quote, the lowest as a murderer. Not a murderer, as a killer, it's a better word. He's not really murdering, but he just killed people. Maybe he's splitting hairs, but technically it is a difference. Now there's Samson. Basic fundamental faith. I've been with you all the way from Egypt throughout this whole time. I have selected these judges throughout this whole process. Now, Samson's going about to be one of the last judges. Eli is the next one, and Samuel is the last. So he's approaching the end of his run of selecting judges. Samson, he creates from somebody who has a very basic fundamental faith of belief in God. That's all it took. His parents weren't fantastic. They were nothing was pronounced about their family line, their history. Didn't own a whole lot. A little bit, like an average-sized town would. And how do I know this? Because the territory of Zorah consisted of small, still does, small plots of land. It's actually a fairly mountainous terrain area. You can't grow a whole lot there. The small sections that you can grow, that's what you grow on. That's about it. It's not a really big territory. There's a reason why it's a very small little, almost like a drive, one light town, one stop light town. That's pretty much all that's there. It's not a whole lot.
Plum town. You put your head out the window and it's plum gone.
So the family is small, not of a great stature like all of the other judges. Their families were very important families. Huge amongst all of Israel. Manoah wasn't. He was just a normal, ordinary guy. But he had faith in God, and God said, it was just written in Haggai, I've still been with you. And yes, you're nobody. I'm selecting you anyway. So it's kind of a shift in what his process is. Samuel is the same way. He's actually, his family line is a nobody. But God selects him anyway. Again, Nazarite vow for the rest of his life. Eli, granted, he's the high priest, the screwy judge in there for 39 years, but we won't discuss him yet. That's a whole other storyline. So I hope I impressed just a little bit that there's actually a separation that God's making with Samson and his family from his past, from God's own past of selecting people. Samson, he's raising up from the ground up, literally, and he's selected him from no one. A nobody line, no family history, and making him judge of Israel.
Isn't that what he's doing with all of us?
That's what we hope. Yes, Susan.
I think, to add to what you just said, it's interesting that she has to be told, and so does Manoah, not to let her eat anything unclean. Mm-hmm. There's a possibility
they
weren't even keeping kosher.
They probably weren't.
You know, what we would call it the church would call it backslidden.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
To a degree, to have to be reminded that.
Most likely, that is the truth. That's probably very, very true. I mean, look at where they live.
One more thing. Yeah.
They live in a territory that is covered with Philistines.
Yeah.
All right? Yeah, the people are classified as pigs. What they eat is also equally as disgusting. So yeah, there is a good chance. There's a very good chance these people were not Torah observant in the fashion that their predecessors had been. Hence, to be reminded. This is what it means to be Nazarite. Okay, we can do that. It's a little bit of a memory strike. Yes, any other questions, comments? I know I'm like 15 minutes over time. Yes, Tammy.
Hey, maybe that's why God made him a Nazarite, because maybe the only by making him a Nazarite,
cleaning him up,
he put up his entire family, unclean meat, and whatever else they were doing, because, you know, yeah, she might be able to drink her liquor after she weaned him, but even after that, she still could not serve him.
Right.
Could not serve him wine, could not serve him wine.
Exactly. Well, no other questions, comments? Thank you for your time.